Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today has been a college professor for nearly 50 years, a self-described liberal English professor. He's observed a shift in American culture, and especially on college campuses, that he finds alarming. A shift that takes newfound and, frankly, long overdue awareness of privilege, identity, and appropriation to a place where it's stifling debate over provocative ideas, of shaming viewpoints that dissent from favored views on campus. Robert Boyers fears a loss of robust debate and democratic values in this excess. His new book is titled The Tyranny of Virtue, Identity, the Academy, and the Hunt for Political Heresies. It's published by Scribner's. In it, he lays out 9 essays drawn from his own experiences on campus and in scholarly organizations, describing and examining ideas and issues that have made university life a minefield. Boyers is the editor of Salamagundi, a professor of English at Skidmore College, and the director of the New York State Summer Writers Institute. He's the author of 10 previous books, and he's written for magazines such as Harper's, The New Republic, The Nation, and The Chronicle of Higher Education. And he joins us today on Studio Tulsa. Robert Boyers, a welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
A pleasure. Thank you.
In a growing illiberal world, you write of a growing illiberal climate on college campuses. Tell us why you decided to write The Tyranny of Virtue, especially in a day and age. By writing this book, you're putting yourself right in the firing line.
Well, yes. Though there are many people, including faculty members on my own campus, who are not at all happy about the book I've written. There are many others who are grateful. So there is, as on so many issues in the culture right now, a very, very clear and notable division. I mean, I wrote my book because, you know, I've been on a college campus for more than a half a century, and I've watched all sorts of developments occurring, and I've written about them and thought about them, and things finally reached a point at which I thought I needed to devote an entire book to the subject, and so I've done so. I actually got the idea of writing the book about 5 years ago when I gave a public lecture at the New School for Social Research in Manhattan on some of these issues, and the response to it was so great and so favorable. The piece was published in the Chronicle of Higher Education, and there were just hundreds of letters that came to me as a result of that one piece, and that was what I really needed to get me going and writing the book. And of course, many of the issues that are covered in the book have been discussed in the national press in recent years. And these issues have had to do with preventing controversial speakers from appearing on campuses and so on and that sort of thing. And in a couple of those instances, as at Middlebury College and a couple of other places, there have been violent incidents involved in those efforts to obstruct these speakers. But I'm more concerned with the sort of the everyday life of the campus and the demand for so-called safe spaces, the desire to cleanse the campus of controversy and dissent altogether, to get people to toe the line with respect to the kinds of books that are taught and the kinds of discussions that can be conducted both in classes and outside of classes and that sort of thing. And then I've been also concerned with what I call the weaponizing of certain ideas, which are ideas that have some legitimacy that are interesting to me and to other people, ideas like privilege, for example, and appropriation, which have been, as I say, weaponized and used as weapons to prevent people from making ordinary distinctions, for example, between one sort of privilege and another, and the kinds of privilege that actually might have an effect on the way people conduct their lives, on inequality, and then the other kinds of privilege, which are just sort of ordinary kinds of privilege that everybody more or less enjoys in one degree or another. So I've basically written the book in order to call attention to the way that frequently even good ideas are distorted and misused.
One of the things I was interested in, you know, we have a growing worldwide illiberal climate. Do you think that the illiberal climate you're describing is on college campuses is a reaction to that growing illiberalism worldwide?
I don't know that it is, actually. I've thought a lot about that, and it's a good question, and I don't have, you know, anything like a clear and convincing answer to that question. I mean, I know that, for example, the kinds of liberalism that I describe in my book have had an effect on the national political scene, because people on the political right have been pointing to this kind of a liberalism on college campuses and making the case that that basically their own forms of illiberalism, their own efforts to quiet controversy and so on, are in response to what they see occurring in the more liberal precincts of the culture. So I know it's had an effect on that. I mean, Donald Trump often talks about what's going on college campuses as a way of explaining or excusing some of the things that he and his friends want to accomplish.
Or exploiting exploiting those divides.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So I know that's been a very clear consequence, and I mean that's indisputable. But I don't know that it's operated in the other way, that these kinds of things are a response to illiberalism or tyranny in the larger political culture. I don't know that that's true.
Well, certainly the issues you write about and the tyranny of virtue are at play every day in both our high culture and pop culture, in politics and workplaces, but higher education seems to be the ground zero for a lot of these conflicts about our beliefs and how we express our opinions, how we respond to diverse viewpoints, and at the same time respectfully challenge privileged beliefs that may have been taken granted over the decades. Do you believe that colleges?
Right, and there is, you can see a very clear sort of effect of the kinds of things that I describe in college campuses, sort of spreading to the wider culture. I mean, there have been very strange stories emerging from the publishing world, for example, and from the museum culture, where we find other kinds of tyranny that you sort of never imagined before. For example, there's a Twitter hashtag called Own Voices, which has to do with the efforts in the publishing industry to prevent people of a particular ethnicity or race or religion from taking on subjects that have to do with people from another ethnicity, from another culture, so that white authors who would submit a novel to a publisher or to an agent for publication are told that if their book deals with black characters, that book can't be seriously considered for publication. This is just a kind of absurdity that is one of the effects of what I call identity politics in my book. The notion that people of a particular ethnicity own the experiences of their own people, and that no one else is permitted to poach those subjects for their own purposes, so that the imagination itself is constrained and confined to stick to its own very narrow experience. In the same way, we're told that painters are not permitted to paint subjects that have to do with the lives and the experiences and the histories of people unlike themselves. Perhaps some of your listeners have heard about the controversy around a painting that was hung at the Whitney Museum, at the Whitney Biennial, a few years ago. It was a painting called Open Casket, and it was made or inspired by a famous iconic photograph of the 1950s of a young black man named Emmett Till
yeah,
who had been murdered. And this painting was made by a white painter named Dana Schutz. And when the painting was hung at the Whitney Biennial, along with dozens and dozens of other paintings, many artists signed a petition demanding that the painting be taken down and destroyed because it had done this unforgivable thing by sort of taking upon itself, right, a subject that that really belonged only to black people. I must say, by the way, that the Whitney Museum did not capitulate to these demands, and many, many notable black artists and writers, from painter Carol Walker to the novelist Zadie Smith, defended the right of the painter Dana Schutz to make this kind of painting. So, I mean, what I try to do is sort of get inside these kinds of disputes and to try to understand what they reflect, what they come out of. Zadie Smith, in an article on this dispute in Harper's Magazine, had a very interesting thing to say. She said, well, of course, obviously, this white woman had every right to make a painting of this subject, but she said, we also, in looking at the painting, have a right to consider whether it does justice to its subject. She said, I, for myself, look at this painting and don't think of it as a successful painting. I don't think it does justice to its subject. And then, of course, that's what we do when we look at works of art, when we read books, we assess them, we think about whether they do justice to whatever their subject happens to be, and we make our judgments on that basis. But we don't make it on a strictly racialist basis. And I think that's the kind of important distinction that I'm trying to get at in my book. And I find lots of encouragement and inspiration from people like Zadie Smith who are doing that work as well.
Do you believe that culture in general and colleges especially are losing their capacity for that clash of ideas and ideals, of a civil discussion of the merits of and debate over whether that is a, for example, a successful painting, or if somebody presents a thought or idea of whether that has merit?
This can lead to the kinds of sort of automatic knee-jerk responses and rejections to legitimate works of art and novels and academic studies that make it very difficult, really, to conduct serious debate and discussion on a college campus and in the culture generally. I tell many stories in my book, based many of them on my own experience, and some of them may seem, you know, small, and you're reluctant when you tell these stories to make a big deal of them and to think that they are symptomatic of very large and broad developments in the culture. But if you tell enough of those stories and you put them together and you see the direction in which they point, well, then you do see a kind of coherent suggestion of where we are at this moment in the culture. I tell, for example, the way a very brilliant student in one of my classes, one of the best students I've had in recent years, a very woke young woman, was enrolled in a class in which we were studying a novel called The Pickup by a very great South African writer named Nadine Gordimer, a Nobel Prize-winning author. And this is a white woman, very, very invested in struggles against apartheid in South Africa for decades and decades, devoting many books to the subject. But my young student read this book and was enraged about the presumption, what she took to be the presumption of a white woman in devoting a book to a subject, the conflicts of people in South Africa and in other countries having to do with race. She was offended by the fact that we go into the house of a black Islamic family and we look at it very closely in this novel. And she felt this is just simply not to be done. And as a result, she drew conclusions about the author and about the motives involved in the book that were completely off base, and which in many ways are very disappointing, again, because this was one of the most brilliant students I've had in recent years, but she had been programmed in this way. I'm using that word. It's a loaded word. I felt she had been programmed to respond in this knee-jerk way to this very subtle book that we were studying together. And again, I can't demand that anyone agree with me about the merits of a particular book, but I think I can hope to persuade someone that dismissing a book simply on the grounds that it's written by a white person is preposterous. So this is part of the, I think, the wages of identity politics that we are beginning to observe and have been observing over the last 5 or 6 years on college campuses, and it's alarming and disappointing.
My guest today is Robert Boyer, a professor of English at Skidmore College. He's the editor of Salamagundi there, a quarterly magazine of politics, culture, and literature. His latest book is titled The Tyranny of Virtue, Identity, the Academy, and the Hunt for Political Heresies. It's published by Scribner's. Well, when we talk about privilege, toleration, identity, appropriation, behind these four words, there are real-life issues that we are struggling with every day in our culture. In fact, one of the reasons we're struggling with is because for many years, many abuses have been shielded over the years through racism, sexism, discrimination. Is there a divide in how these issues are reflected in culture at large and on campuses, or do you feel like this is something we're struggling with everywhere?
I think we're struggling with it everywhere, and it's real. I mean, look, if you just think about the term privilege, I mean, the term privilege refers to something that's real. We all know it's real. We know that that for a very long time, to be white is to have a certain kind of privilege that is not shared by people who are not white. Okay, this is a given. We know that in many places and times, a black family applying to rent an apartment in a certain kind of building in a particular location would be denied that right, whereas a white person with the same kinds of credentials and so on would be accepted and could rent the apartment. So that constitutes privilege. We know that there are other kinds of privilege that have to do with the capacity to hire tutors to help your children to do well on entrance examinations. That's a privilege. It's a privilege that comes with money and background and preparation. I mean, all of those things are real, and there's no use in denying them because I think to a very considerable degree, they're obvious. Where they come from, we can argue about. How durable they are, we can argue about. Whether the situation of privilege has changed in considerable degree over the course of the last half century, we can argue about that as well. We know that a great many more black people, for example, have entered the middle class and have opportunities and privileges available to them, which were not available to most black people a half a century ago. So there have been certain changes. So there really is privilege. But to then take the term privilege and to assume, for example, that all white people enjoy the same privileges, enjoy them in the same ways, exploit them in the same ways, use their privileges to oppress other people in the same ways, that seems to me illegitimate and unfortunate. And that is frequently the way the word privilege has been used in recent years. It is possible to deploy the word privilege as a kind of a put-down so that a speaker, for example, who's giving a talk on a college campus, and who has the attention of an audience, is accused of exploiting his or her white privilege simply by virtue of delivering that lecture and having people listen to it. I give examples of this sort of thing in my book, where a perfectly respectable and responsible person is giving a lecture on a subject and is immediately told by someone in the audience when the question and answer period emerges that he has enjoyed white privilege, which is sort of an attempt in some way to distract attention from the substance of the talk and to shift it onto another ground altogether. Why would anyone do that? Well, I one of the reasons that a person would do that is that in doing so, the person wishes to signal his or her own virtue. I am virtuous. This kind of comment says, I am virtuous by virtue of calling out, right, the privilege of a person who is presumably not alert to the privilege he is exercising by delivering this lecture. So that constitutes what I would call a kind of distortion in our understanding of the word privilege. The speaker in that situation has become the target of an attack, not for anything he has said, not for anything he has done, but simply by virtue of being a white person. And that sort of takes much of the substance and the meaning and the point of privilege out of the equation. And you're no longer really talking about privilege in a serious way. You're simply using it as a put-down and as a way of sort of proclaiming one's own virtue in being alert to the concept of privilege. So, and that's the sort of distortion that that has occurred with respect to many other concepts and terms that we use.
Well, I was going to say you should also mention gender as a part of that as well. That's also an issue. But where is the dividing line between raising awareness of inequality, of opinions, and checkmating a debate?
Well, that's a very sort of difficult sort of question, as you well know.
Yeah.
Think, for example, about the term political correctness. We understand that political correctness is, insofar as it operates as a means of preventing people from talking about difficult or uncomfortable issues, that political correctness is an unfortunate thing. If I can't talk about a subject because it makes people uncomfortable, right, and political correctness tells me that I can't go there, I can't talk about those things, that's a very unfortunate consequence of political correctness. But then, if we think about political correctness in a more generous way, we might say to ourselves, well, political correctness also declares that I can't call someone a disgusting name. I can't use the N-word to speak of a black person. I can't use a comparably disgusting term to talk about a Jewish person or a gay person. Those are areas in which what you might call political correctness serves, I think, a useful, and I would call it even civilizing, purpose. And I think it's a good thing that we've come to a point in our society where most of us understand that you can't have civil discourse and you can't really have a decent society in which those kinds of terms are used. At the same time, this sensitivity, this alertness, can lead to unwanted forms of tyranny. An example, we've had over the course of recent months several fairly well-publicized incidents involving the use of the N-word when it is read or quoted out from a text. So, for example, the black writer Walter Mosley, one of our leading black writers, wrote an op-ed piece in the New York Times about a month or so ago in which he talked about having been called out and brought up on charges for reading out the N-word in one of his classes when he was quoting it from a text that they were studying. And he said, well, this is ridiculous. It's one thing, right, to be sensitive to the term. He even said in his piece, I am the N-word. But reading it out and quoting it, well, you know, that's very different from using it as a term of derogation to as a nasty term to address someone with. So and this has come up in a number of other institutions and a number of other contexts and so on. So is that a terrible thing that we should be thinking about that? No, it's useful to think about when, on what occasions certain kinds of language might or might not be appropriate. It's important to think about the fact that one situation is very different from another. Is it different, for example, to read out the N-word in a classroom where it is being actually discussed, where it becomes an object of study? And on the other hand, reading it out in a large auditorium in which the audience is virtually all white, is there a difference between reading it out in the one place and reading it out in the other? I mean, there's no reason why we can't talk about those kinds of distinctions and think about what's involved in the experience of people who are present on those different occasions. So, again, whenever we have a sort of an automatic response to certain terms or certain ideas which seem to us indisputable, it's a good idea, you know, to ask serious questions about what those sort of automatic responses entail and to try to think about them much more concretely. And that's one of the things I try to do in my book.
My guest today is Robert Boyers. He's a professor of English at Skidmore College. His latest book is titled The Tyranny of Virtue. Throughout the book, you use examples from your own teaching, from your own college. I imagine that's provoked a very interesting reaction on campus. What has been the reaction to this book?
Well, it's a strange, it's a strange thing. I'll tell you, there's a sort of a very funny aspect in the reaction. You know, I have lots of friends. I've been at the college for half a century, and I have many friends who teach at the college, and some of whom have bought multiple copies of my book to give to people for Christmas. So that's been very nice, very gratifying. Every now and then, when I'm sort of sitting in our college cafeteria with friends, having lunch, a faculty member, in some cases a younger faculty member, whose name I don't even know, from another department. I know everybody in my own department, but I don't know everybody in other departments, will come by my table and say, excuse me, I just want to tell you that that I've read your book, and I really think it's very important and helpful. Thank you. And then on a couple of those occasions, the person has put a finger up to the lips, to his or her lips, as if to say, shh, don't tell anyone that I'm saying this to you. Because there is clearly an understanding that there are many people at the institution who are not happy about the book. My sense is that a great many people at the institution have read it. But I think that in general, there are signs of a pushback against some of the things that I describe in my book. And I'm perfectly comfortable walking the corridors of my own institution, knowing that that some people disagree fervently with what I've written.
Robert Boyers, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you so very much for having me.
Robert Boyers is a professor of English at Skidmore College and the author of The Tyranny of Virtue, Identity, the Academy, and the Hunt for Political Heresies. It's published by Scribner's. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.